තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස Good morning everyone. Today we'll continue from the place we stopped last week. If you remember, if I recall some of the information we discussed last week, at the moment we are discussing about the ultimate realities that are mentioned in the Theravada tradition. We gave a list, I think you still have the handout, and also so far we have explained some imperative traits or characteristics the realities as advocated by the Theravada tradition. Then we came into the list of the realities. We are not going to explain them in detail because this series of lectures is about the ultimacy mainly, and we are just brushing up the list of realities. So we discussed, we know that there are three types of conditioned realities mentioned in the Theravada tradition. One is consciousness, and then the mental factors, and the corporeality. Corporeality means the matter, the reality. Sometimes we use the word corporeality. Corporeality means something which is known in the physical world, which belongs to the physical world. Then, so far we discussed about the relationship between the mental factors and the consciousness. Mental factors are ultimately classified as into three groups. The ethically variable group, which we didn't discuss, which we are going to discuss today. Then the unwholesome group, we called it akusala. Then the beautiful mental factors, which are called sobana. Consciousness that associate the unwholesome mental factors are called akusala consciousness. Then the consciousness that are associating the beautiful mental factors, sobana mental factors, are called beautiful consciousness. In Pali we call them the sobana chittas. Then we are left with some consciousness, 18 consciousnesses, which are only connected with ethically variable group. That is, we call it Anya Samana. They are the very basic characteristics of cognition, very basic attributes of cognition. So today we are going to discuss about these 13 Chetasikas and about the 18 consciousness that associate these mental factors. If you go into the handout which we distributed last 2 weeks ago, please go to the page number 6, which explains about the Chetasikas. Page number 6, 13 Anya Samana Chetasikas. Anya Samana, the translation is ethically variable mental factors. Ethically variable, because in ethics we call good and bad. It's a philosophical aspect called ethics. So in Buddhism we have absolute goodness, absolute badness. Absolute means there is a very clear black and white definition about what is good and what is bad. There is no mixture in Buddhist teachings, like something can be good in a certain context and something can be good in a different context, because when we look into the reality objectively, sometimes we feel like some may argue like killing a terrorist or killing someone who is going to harm the society would be a good act in terms of the in the social perspective of saving many lives. At the same time, we are doing the harm for the person who is being killed. So then we weigh what is more, the benefit to the society or the harm for the person, and then we may categorize it as a good act. But according to Buddhism, it is a very clear-cut definition. If any act is initiated with bad intentions, evil intentions, we consider it as akusala or unwholesome, regardless of its consequences. then if some act is motivated with a good intention, for instance, someone with a good intention tries to help someone, and in the end we end up in harming him, but still, as the motivation was wholesome, motivation was good, we consider it as an ethically good, admirable act. So what is the criteria to decide what is good or bad in Buddhist teachings? These chetasikas are the measuring stick, the yardstick to decide what is good and what is bad. So we come into the 13, so that is why we call ethically variable means these 13 chetasikas, 13 mental factors, can associate both wholesome and unwholesome mental factors. They can associate both wholesome and unwholesome mental factors. Unwholesome, the 14 we already discussed in brief, and also this beautiful mental factors, 25 mental factors. So these ethically variable means, for instance, if you take number 11 is effort. There is an effort in doing unwholesome acts, and also there is an effort in doing wholesome acts. So effort, virya, the exertion or this energy to continue certain acts without stopping, can be found in both wholesome and unwholesome sides. So that's why we call this ethically variable. These mental factors are called ethically variable, because they can be found in good and bad acts equally. Right, so we shall be discussing them one by one according to the list. So before we go into this explanation, I would like to draw the same diagram we drew last time, the chetasikas. We divided it into three groups, if you remember. Anya samana, ethically variable, 13. Then we have akusala, unwholesome, 14. Then sobana, beautiful, 25. Then we categorized the consciousness, citta, into a few groups. We divide it as kamavachara, belonging to the sensual realm. So it was, then we have rupavachara, arupavachara, and lokuttara. Right, lokuttara. So these are belonging to the sensual realm, belonging to Brahma realms, and then supramundane, beyond the mundane world. These are the attainments. Then we divided this kamavachara into three groups: akusala, unwholesome, ahetuka, which we are going to discuss today. We call it rootless. So we shall explain it. Then we have kama sobana, right? Kama sobana. We have 24 here, we have 18 here, and we have 12 here. And this was divided into kusala, vipaka, resultant, and kriya. Right? Kusala, vipaka, kriya. Then all these were divided into kusala, vipaka, kriya, 5 each. Then we have 12 arupavachara, divided again, kusala, vipaka, kriya, lokuttara, 8, only as kusala and vipaka, no kriya. So then we also mentioned, if any chitta is associating, I'll use the blue pen, maybe this thing, akusala chetasikas, those chittas were called akusala chittas. Akusala chetasikas associating akusala chittas. If any citta associates sobhana chetasikas, any of the sobhana chetasikas, those cittas were called sobhana, and it included all these rupa, arupa, lokuttara, and then out of the kama avachara group up to here, if you remember, here. We can also draw it like half the kama avachara. Anyway. So it belonged to one part of the kama avachara, one third of the kama avachara, and all the rupa avachara, arupa avachara, and lokuttara. These are the spiritual attainments, we can call. This is attained with samatha meditation, the tranquility meditation, and this is attained with insight meditation, vipassana meditation. And in the sensual realm, when we do wholesome deeds, when we are born in the whole in a sugati abode, blissful abode, and when the arahants do their acts, they have such thoughts. So these are all called sobhana. Why they are called sobhana? Because they associate sobhana chetasikas. So if any chitta associates sobhana chetasikas, they are called sobhana chittas. Collectively, if any chitta associates akusala, unwholesome, they are called unwholesome consciousness. Akusala chittas. And also we mentioned, these are the very basic traits of cognition. Each and every chitta should have at least some of these basic traits. So therefore, we also mention, even though we term this as akusala, it doesn't mean that these chittas only have the akusala chetasikas. They also contain anya samana chetasikas. Even the sobhanas do contain anya samana chetasikas. Right? They do contain. But there are 18 chittas. There are 18 types of chittas which doesn't have neither have akusalas nor the sobhanas. They only contain the anya samanas. They only contain anya samanas. Right? They only contain. So what we have to be careful is, if we say anya samana arises only in 18 ahetuka, it is an utterly wrong statement according to the Theravadins. Because anya samana arises in all sort of chittas. But these 18, which we are going to explain, these 18 do not associate any of the akusala or any of the sobhana chetasikas. They do not associate any of them. They only associated these ethically variable mental factors. But when we come to the akusala chittas, they associate the ethically variable group and also the akusala group. Because of this predominant akusala group, we call them akusala chittas. And in the sobhana, beautiful consciousness, they associate the beautiful mental factors and also the ethically variable mental factors, but we term them as sobhana because of their predominance, because of the their predominant nature. So now we are going to discuss what are these ethically variable mental factors, which are called anya samana. We have 13, starting with passa. Passa is contact. I think I have given it in the handout with the translation, contact. Here contact means every chitta, every cognition should have a certain contact with the object it cognizes. Should have a contact with the object it cognizes. It means there should be a certain relationship with the object. So this contact, which is a mental factor, is very hard to explain as a separate property. In some suttas, Buddha has mentioned this passa in his manifestation, not in its actual characteristic. Because when we come into realities, in Buddhist teachings, especially in Theravada teachings, we have four types of there are four ways a certain reality can be explained. Sometimes the reality is expressed in its intrinsic nature, in its basic characteristic. Sometimes its function, it performs. Sometimes its ability to perform the function. Sometimes its manifestation, how it gets manifest to us when we are observing, sometimes with its result, and finally with its causes. Actually, there are five ways altogether. Yeah, six ways if I count. A reality can be explained in its intrinsic quality. One is its intrinsic quality. At that time, we are directly explaining the reality. For example, hardness, if you call about patavi, material reality, the hardness, explaining patavi as hardness is explaining its intrinsic quality. Sometimes we can explain something based on its function, the function it performs. For instance, when we are talking about kusalas, we say it dispels the unwholesomeness, dispels the akusala, wholesomeness, dispels the akusala, unwholesomeness. That's its function. Sometimes its ability to do that function. Sometimes its manifestation, how it appears to a yogi who observes these ultimate realities. Sometimes, in another instance, we may explain a reality based on its result. Like the smoke. When we say about smoke, we naturally tend to know about a fire. Then, for instance, when we say about the bhava rupas, we call the sex faculty. It's not the sex organ. We are talking about something that remains in the entire body, which enables us to distinguish the male and femaleness, maleness and femaleness. So it is explained normally in the tradition as the reason for this male appearance and female appearances. So then sometimes we may explain a reality based on its cause. So likewise, there are various approaches the reality can be explained in the Buddhist teachings. So therefore, the passa is normally explained in its manifestation, But according to the sutras and according to the Abhidhamma in the Theravada tradition, passa is a mental factor. It's a separate mental factor. Because Buddha has mentioned in the Anupada Sutta, it arises and passes away, like similar to other chetasikas like Vedana, Sanya and so forth. So passa is the mental factor which acts as a bridge between the consciousness and the object. And the object, there are many ways to explain this passa. For instance, how strong, how large, we normally use the word, that how large the passa is, the contact is, the larger the consciousness is. For instance, if we gave an example, we can take a bottle. Sometimes we may focus on the entire bottle with our consciousness. Sometimes we may focus on the neck only. Sometimes the entire bottle. So while we focus on the neck, the upper part of the bottle, the head of the bottle, that time we normally say the contact of the consciousness is only this area. So passa makes a contact here. So that enables the consciousness to focus on this area. If the passa contacts the entire bottle, the consciousness is able to focus on the entire thing. And we also mentioned consciousness is delimiting the object from other objects. I mean, various times we explain the consciousness delimits the objects. Many times we discuss on this matter. It's called the focus. That focus to happen properly, passa is necessary. Passa is necessary. Contact is necessary. They are supporting each other mutually and occurring at the same time. Occurring simultaneously and also mutually assisting each other. Another analogy to explain passa, explain with the contact is, if you want to take something with our hands, so for instance, we take this duster from the hand, if my hand is the consciousness, it has to make a contact with this duster first. So passa is like this contact of the hand with the thing that is taken. So likewise, when the consciousness focuses on a particular object, there is a certain kind of a mental factor which touches the object. So then this passa can also be explained as the cause for the feeling. Cause for the feeling. It touches the object, so the consciousness is able to focus on a certain area, on a certain part of the object or the entire object. Then this passa also causes the flavor of the object to get manifest. Flavor of the object. Another analogy for how the passa is related to feeling is we take an orange and we squeeze it with our hands. So passa is like the hand which squeezes the orange, which is the object in the analogy. So passa squeezes the object. So likewise, the hand squeezes the orange, the passa squeezes the object. It touches the object. So what happens? The juice comes out. The orange juice comes out, which is the flavor of this object of orange. So likewise, when the passa touches the object, the flavor, the inherited flavor of the object gets manifested. It comes up. It becomes evident, prominent to the consciousness. So the Vedana is able to feel it. Vedana is able to feel it. That's why the Buddha mentioned in the famous Paticchasamuppada doctrine, passa paccaya vedana. The contact causes the feeling. So therefore, passa or the contact is taken as one of the fundamental necessities in the conscious realm, in cognition. It supports the consciousness to take the focus on the object. It decides the area, how large the object is to the consciousness. And then it also facilitates the functioning of Vedana, the feeling, by bringing up the flavor of the object. So that is called the passa. So it is found in each and every citta. All the cittas have this mental factor, which is called passa, the contact. So the simile is very difficult to explain this mental factor. The analogy is, there are a few analogies I gave. When we take something with our hands, first the hand has to make a contact on the object. So this passa is like that. Then, so in that analogy, the hand is the consciousness. Then in relation with the feeling, passa is like the hand which squeezes the orange, which is the object. So passa touches the object, so the flavor comes out, like the hand where the orange juice comes out when the orange is being squeezed with the hand. Then we come into the next mental factor, which is called feeling, Vedana. Vedana. This is also one of the fundamental attributes of cognition. If I remind, now the 13 anyasamana chetasikas, 13 ethically variable mental factors, they are actually divided into two groups. This is divided into two groups, 7 and 6. The first 7 is universal. Universal means they are found in each and every consciousness of the Theravada tradition. These 7 can be found in each and every consciousness. So we can term them as the very basic attributes of cognition. Very basic attributes of cognition. Among them, now we have to add also the citta. So it becomes 8. Citta is the focus, which is the forerunner in this cognition, act of cognition. Then actually, the focus cannot happen alone without these, at least these seven mental factors. So what these are, the 7 mean the first 7. Passa, Vedana, Sanya, Chetana, Ekagata, Jivitendriya and Manasikara. These are the 7. These 7 are universal mental factors. Can be found in all the wholesome or unwholesome, it can be found in all types of consciousness. Sorry. Now we come into the Vedana. Vedana is called the feeling. Vedana is the feeling. Feeling is explained like, now citta focuses on object. sthita focus on the object. So what happens? The passa contacts the object. Passa contacts the object. So what happens? The thing is, now each and every object has its flavor. We call it, in Pali we call it Aramana Rasa. A flavor of the object. Each and every object has its flavor, inbuilt flavor. Because in philosophy, we have a branch called ethics and aesthetics. In the aesthetics, there are a branch of philosophers who consider that there is an objective beauty in the world. There is something called objective art. Some would call art is always subjective. It depends on the person. It depends on the perspective of the person, how you observe a certain thing. In Buddhism, we accept both objective and subjective beauty. Objective and subjectivity. Sometimes the beauty is appreciated based on the characteristics or the desires of the person. Sometimes the object itself, the beauty or the ugliness or the good or bad qualities can be found in the object itself. Out of these two, Buddhism expresses about inbuilt quality called a beauty. Each and every object has this inbuilt quality. Sometimes our subjective influence, our cognition is influenced by our subjective or our how our mind is brought up, our cultural habits, our social norms and so forth can greatly affect how we decide something as good or bad. Good or bad mean the sense of beautiful or not beautiful, attractive or not non-attractive. But according to the teachings, what we see is the object itself, the beauty or the ugliness, good or bad qualities are inbuilt within the object. So that is what we call the flavor. Flavor is this pleasantness or the unpleasantness or the intermediate state of an object. So we normally say there are three flavors of the object. The pleasant flavor, unpleasant flavor, indeterminate, like middle flavor. We call it majjata rasa. Not upekha, we call it majjata, the middle flavor. Pleasant, unpleasant, we can also call neither pleasant nor unpleasant. It's like a middle flavor. So how to decide it? According to the tradition, we give social norms like there is a criteria to decide whether object is pleasant or unpleasant. Then what happens is, when the chitta focuses on an object, because of the contact, the passa, this flavor gets manifested or it becomes evident to the consciousness. It becomes evident. The flavor becomes evident. It comes up like the juice comes out from orange which is being squeezed. So with this chitta, there appears a mental factor called Vedana or a certain mental factor which becomes sensitive to this flavor of the object. It becomes sensitive to the flavor of the object. While the consciousness cognizes the object, Vedana, while cognizing, the focusing on the, because the main act is the focus. So we normally say all the mental factors in a one cognition has the same object. All the mental factors have the same object. That is the object of the chitta. What happens is, this Vedana becomes sensitive. I use the word sensitive. Since while it cognizes the object with the chitta, it becomes sensitive to the flavor of the object. The main focus of the chitta is the object. The main sensitivity of the Vedana. Vedana becomes, Vedana starts to feel the touch, the sense, the flavor of the object. So we call it the feeling. If the flavor is pleasant, we call it a pleasant feeling. If the flavor is unpleasant, we call it unpleasant feeling. If the flavor is middle, we call it indeterminate, low, or we can call economist feeling, like upekkha feeling. And sometimes even the object has a pleasant flavor because of different reasons, the chitta may, or the vedana may take it as an unpleasant. Even the pleasant object, a pleasant object can be taken as unpleasant. Even the unpleasant object can be taken as pleasant. Depends on the subjective attributes. But there are some consciousness. There are certain consciousness. We really, especially the resultant consciousness, the vipaka, resultant consciousness. They take the flavor as it is. They take the flavor as it is. When it comes to the wholesome, unwholesome consciousness, there can be a subjective influence on how we consider about the object. Right? So the main thing I want to emphasize here is Vedana is sensitive to the flavor of the object, which is an inbuilt quality of the object itself. Which is an inbuilt quality of the object itself. And it is said that there is no consciousness which arises without Vedana. There is no consciousness which arises without Vedana. So how do we, what is the philosophy behind this? Is if any cognition happens, if there is any cognition occurring, that cognition has to be sensitive to the flavor of the object. Why is that? Otherwise, the cognition is not coming in, it's not complete. So the rule that we make based on observing this is, the fundamental that we make is, if there is to be a cognition, act of cognition in the Theravada teachings, if act of cognition is explained according to the Theravada teachings, it has to have a contact with the object, that is very obvious. At the same time, it has to be sensitive to the flavor of the object, otherwise the cognition is not complete. So why do we say that? Because this samsara, this functioning of consciousness, is happening in a way which attracts the craving. So why? What is the greatest food for craving? The best food for craving is the feeling. Feeling is the most attractive food or the thing for the craving. So in the end, what the feeling feels is the flavor of the object. So flavor of the object also plays a huge role in our tradition, in the continuation of samsara. It is known to the mind with the Vedana. So based on the pleasant feeling, we have a great desire to continue our living, this samsara. So therefore, Vedana has become a very basic mental factor in the cognition. So there is no consciousness without Vedana. Then we come into the third mental factor, which is called sanya. Sanya, which is called perception. Sanya is perception. So how do we explain sanya in the Theravada perspective? So now the chitta became sensitive to the flavor of the object, and then there is some kind of a uniqueness in every object. Uniqueness means a certain attribute of the object which enables us to distinguish it from other objects. The uniqueness of the object is seen two things. Our mind, even at the very basic level, mind is able to distinguish this and this. Even animals can do it. Animals know who is their master, especially a dog would know who is the master and who is the stranger. He's able to distinguish this. And even among twins, ones who have the very similar figures, we are able to distinguish, especially a mother is able to distinguish who is the elder and who is the younger. Why is that? She is very familiar with the certain traits of the object. Because a stranger would get confused, who is the elder or who is the younger, and he would easily get confused, the both as the same. But with close observation, we are able to see there are certain attributes that each and every object possess. So we call this the uniqueness of every object. Each and every object has this uniqueness. So when the consciousness focuses on the object, there is a mental factor which becomes sensitive to this uniqueness. So when the consciousness knows the object, Vedana becomes sensitive to the flavor, Sanya becomes sensitive to this uniqueness. when someone has developed the sanya, a sharp sanya, which is utterly necessary, he becomes a master in a certain subject. He becomes a professional, he becomes proficient in a certain object. Proficiency increases. It means, like, for instance, we go into mechanics, motor mechanics. Person like who doesn't have much knowledge in the motor mechanics, like I do, I myself, would not be able to distinguish two things which are in the engine, because they appear similar to me. I'll not be able to say what is this part and what is this that part, and so mostly they appear similar, same to us. And sometimes also when we go to a foreign country, all the people in the beginning appears very similar to us, but when we are getting familiar with their features, we start to see their differences. So when our sanya is not broad enough, not developed much in a particular subject, we are unable to distinguish the sharp differences, the slight differences, we call trifle differences. We are not able to distinguish them. So what happens? Everything appears similar to us. So that's why when someone is explaining a certain subject in a very subtle or deep level, sometimes if we are not familiar with the subject, we are unable to see the differences what he's talking. So when the sanya is developed, our mind becomes sensitive to the differences, the uniqueness of a certain topic, certain thing, and we are able to say, no, this is anusaya, for instance, this is vasana, this is chitta, this is mental factors. So we are able to distinguish them. So sanya plays a huge role in our understanding. So therefore, and then what happens, if sanya is absent, we are unable to see feel the objects as different. So according to Theravadians, why we have a sense of difference in the various objects? Because the sanya becomes sensitive to the uniqueness of each and every object. If the uniqueness is very difficult to be distinguished, most of the time we may consider it as the same thing. So likewise, sanya is also, if sanya is not present, what happens? The consciousness, the Theravadins would say, consciousness is not effective enough to function properly, because person is unable to distinguish the variants of the objects. That's why sanya is also considered as one of the major factors on consciousness. So someone would say the sanya is something not related to our spirituality, but we can see when the Buddha wanted to explain about contemplations, he never mentioned about anicca panya, he mentioned about anicca sanya. So the commentaries explain that it is the contemplation based on the sanya. Sometimes the sanya can represent the other mental factors. In some occasions, sanya itself has been explained. So it means our contemplation of impermanent suffering and non-self should lead to the level of sanya. It should become something very natural to us, because that is when the sanya vipallasa, in the hallucinations, there is a level of sanya, wrong hallucination, can be removed. Only our contemplation of anicca, dukkha and anatta reaches to the level of sanya. It means it becomes something habitual to us. Then we are able to get rid of such hallucinations. And also plays a huge role in our practice. But it can be found in all the consciousness, wholesome or unwholesome, regardless of the its group. Then we come to the fourth type of mental factor, chetana. Chetra is volition. Right? So normally we translate it as intention, volition. But the very basic explanation of chetana is when the focus happens together with a cluster of mental factors, it's a cluster, mental cluster, the energy of this cluster is chetana. Energy. What is this energy? The energy which supports the group of the mentalities to function properly. It's like in a machine. machine working in air, for instance, the ancient machines, they worked with the pressure, like the hydraulic or the pressure ones, like this, with the steam. So when the steam is the main fuel, right, because of the steam, all the parts of the machine starts to perform the function. So likewise, when the chetana is present, chitta and the remaining chetasikas able to perform their functions properly. It's similar to the tejo in a material cluster. So likewise, chetana gives the energy for the mentalities to perform properly. Should not be misunderstood with virya. Virya is the energy of the mind which enables it to continue with a certain act without stopping it. Chetana is the energy that is required for the entire mentalities to perform their functions properly, even at a one mind moment. So chetana is utterly necessary for this performance. Chitta chetasikas have their individual performances and also the collective performances. For both of these, chetana is necessary. So without the chetana, it's like the consciousness and the mental factors become are like powerless. They become weak. So they are also found in all the consciousness. Then we have ekagata. Ekagata is one-pointedness. This one-pointedness means, now I think once we explain, because someone asked the question about this one-pointedness. So if object can be known, the focus, chitta is the focus of towards an object. Chitta focuses on an object. So then the next thing is, the object can be taken in various ways. This object can be considered as something which is made out of plastic, which is used to rub the board, which is a pink color thing, or which is manufactured in this country and so forth. There are various ways the object can be taken. So while the focus is made towards the object, at the same time, it has to be placed, it has to be kept, or it has to be confined to one of the aspects the object can be taken. Not all the aspects, because the object can be taken in various aspects based on our knowledge about it, or also in the place where it is. So at that time, the consciousness has to be placed in one of the aspects of the object. So that one-pointedness, the ekagata, what it does is, it makes the consciousness to focus only on one aspect of the object rather than focusing on all. So the analogy is given, if someone starts to grab a heap of oranges at once, he will end up keeping nothing. All will go down. All will fall on the ground. So likewise, if the consciousness is not placed on one aspect of the object, it is unable to perform the function and take the object properly. So one-pointedness is also found in all the consciousness, including the akusala consciousness. Someone can have a question, because out of the 12 akusala consciousness, if you go to the list, if we can go to the list of the consciousness, the second page, we find two mohamula chittas. The two mohamula chittas, one is Uddaccha Sampayutta. Uddaccha Sampayutta means a consciousness associated with restlessness, strong restlessness. So how could strong restlessness and the one-pointedness could remain in the same chitta? This analogy is given, a person who is on the horseback, traveling on a horseback, would always shake up and down. It's not always stable, but momentarily, he still remains on the horseback. He doesn't fall down. So likewise, the one-pointedness in this unwholesome consciousness, especially in the Uddaccha consciousness, can have a momentary focus, momentary one-pointedness, though it is being greatly affected by the restlessness of this consciousness. Right? So it is also one of the universal mental attributes. Then we find another mental factor called Jivitindriya. The life faculty. Life faculty. I'm giving a very brief kind of explanation here, not things are given in detail, because each and every chetasika has to be explained in detail. It would take different lectures for each chetasika. Some chetasikas would cover few lectures. So there are lots of information to be given. But in this course, at the moment, I'm just giving a very brief summary, because I want to explain these are the things that are found in the Theravada context. So one, the life faculty is, now it has to be understood with regard to the conscious stream. If I erase this, the consciousness stream. We normally know now already the consciousness appears in a generation. It's not one thing. Consciousness is not one thing. It arises and passes away in a stream, in like a generation. So Jivitindriya, what it does is, Jivitindriya appearing in a one consciousness strengthens the entire cluster. It strengthens the entire cluster. So what happens? Consciousness, this consciousness supports the following consciousness because of its conscious speed. We call it the Arammanaggahana Vega, the speed of the consciousness. We can call it like a momentum. So this, when this consciousness, the mental cluster, is being strengthened by this Jivitindriya, what happens is the stream, it is capable of producing a consciousness which is strong enough to maintain the generation. So likewise, each and every consciousness associates with the Jivitindriya. Function of Jivitindriya is to strengthen the mental cluster. So what happens? The generation keeps on going. It becomes always alive. It becomes active. Active in the sense of not in performance, active in the sense of being alive to continue. Keeps on continuing. So someone can ask, why it is necessary in each and every chitta? Because that Jivitindriya is present, the consciousness keeps on going without breaking down, without stopping. So there are a few forces that are required for the consciousness to continue. We shall be discussing them when we come into a different course about the consciousness. Because now when the mind stream is near to death, the mind stream becomes weaker and it tends to completely get terminated. At that time, the forces are given, support is given with defilements and also the karma force. So likewise, there are various necessities for the conscious stream to continue depending on the occasion where it is. Jivitindriya is one of the reasons for the mental cluster to become strong, so the generation would continue. So there are few various reasons for this generation to continue. Jivitindriya is one factor. So we have a Jivitindriya in the material realm, which enables the continuation of the karma-born matter. Here, Jivitindriya is a mental factor which makes the mental cluster active or stronger, so the generation would continue without getting terminated. Then we have another mental state called Manasikara. We call it attention. Normally we translate it as attention. Attention doesn't mean that we pay attention towards some object. Here attention means each and every consciousness passes away as soon as it arises. Consciousness passes away as soon as it arises. But what happens? Another consciousness occurs. So this occurrence of the new consciousness is because of a certain mental factor which urges it to take a new object, take the object again. So when the consciousness has completely passed away, it repeatedly takes the similar, most of the cases, it may take the same object if it is very close by, except in few cases. So it would take the same object, if it consider this as the Bhavanga Chitta, the same object is taken by the following Chitta. So why another new Chitta would occur taking that same object is because of a mental factor called Manasikara. It involves the mind to take a new object. It makes the mind in in the act of cognition, act of knowing the object. So that is a certain urge, urge towards taking the object again and again. The mind doesn't lose the object. It always have a connection with the objects because of this manasikara. And the next thing is the manasikara of the previous consciousness has a great effect to the following consciousness. Manasikara of the previous consciousness has a great effect to the following consciousness. So normally in the Paramattha Deepani it is explained, sometimes the bhavanga, manasikara of the bhavanga chitta is a great influence for an object to strike at the mind door. Actually the mind door to the consciousness to go towards the new object. So therefore, manasikara in the previous consciousness has a great influence to the following consciousness, and the manasikara which arises in this consciousness, that also makes the mind to get connected, involved with the object. So it is the mental factor which makes the mind to be active in the sense of taking objects, new means the taking objects again and arising, focusing on an object. So it is, that is what is called attention. It should not be misunderstood like when we have a certain someone coming, we would pay attention towards that. This is not the type of attention we are talking here. It's a very subtle kind of a mental factor associating all the consciousness. Then we come into the remaining six. I think the time has already passed. The remaining six are vichara, vitakkha. Vitakkha is initial application of the mind. Initial application of the mind is consciousness is directed. When we are thinking about some object, the mind has to be directed towards that new object. Mind has to be directed. So why the vitakkha is necessary? We normally say in the five sense doors like eye, ear, nose, tongue and body, the objects have already contacted the sense doors. So the consciousness appears where the contact has already happened. So there is no necessity of a vitakkha. But when it is happening in the consciousness occurring in the heart base, which is the sixth base for the consciousness, the object is somewhere else. So the consciousness has to have, consciousness need the support of a certain mental force which makes it to focus towards that far away object, which is locally in a different place. So there maybe it is an imagined object, but still the vitakkha is necessary. That is the force which takes the mind towards that new object. So we call it the initial application. Then we come into the vichara, sustained application. It normally rubs the object. The vitakkha takes the mind towards the object, vichara rubs it. So what happens? Certain traits of the object become evident, comes to the surface. The mind is able to observe, like traits like the shape of the object, the color of the object, the name of the object. Such, we normally say, the shallow attributes of the object are known because of the vichara. Vichara is like an investigation, So that's why it is necessary in the jhana factors, because the object has to be clear. So that clarity is brought by vichara, because it rubs the object. Vitakkha takes the mind towards the object. So it is very necessary the mind to be active. Then the vichara makes the object clearer in your meditation. For instance, if someone is focusing on anapanasati, vitakkha is necessary for our mind to be keep on going on the meditative subject. Then vichara makes the breath more clearer, evident or prominent to the mind. So that is also one. But they do not appear in all the consciousness. Some consciousness may lack these vitakkha and vichara. Then we have another mental factor called adimokkha. Adimokkha is resolution. Resolution is like determination, we can also call. This resolution or determination, normally these are the normal standard translations, right? Sometimes these translations may not fit with my explanation, because they have standardized translation, so that's why I normally follow these terms. So adimokkha means the mental factor which makes the mind to be certain about the object. certainty is felt. There is kind of it's against the uncertainty. So mind is well established on the object in that sense. It becomes certain what is its knowing. Maybe it's knowing it wrongly, it doesn't matter. But there is one sort of certainty in the mind towards the about the object. So this adhimokkha is missing. There is a consciousness about doubt in this akusala group. Doubt in the actual phenomena. That adhimokkha is missing in that consciousness because doubt and the resolution, the determined feeling, the certainty cannot happen together. So therefore, adhimokkha is also missing in certain consciousness. When adhimokkha is present, we have a certain certainty about the object. So according to Theravada tradition, if someone have a wrong beliefs about the life, about the karma, about the creation, so we don't normally call it the faith. So when you explain faith in the Buddhist teachings, that is the faith about the real phenomena, actual phenomena, like the karma has its results and so forth, rebirth, there is a rebirth, there was a previous birth. So these are the real phenomena. So when we want to explain about the faith, first we have to say what is the actual phenomena. The belief in this actual phenomena is considered faith, regardless whether we understand it or not. Then when it comes to false phenomena, like someone has created this world, everything is happening without a cause, everything is predetermined. So these kinds of wrong beliefs, someone may have a faith towards it. That faith is not addressed as saddha in the Buddhist teachings. The faith, the certainty, acceptance of these such wrong phenomena happens with the adhimokkha in the unwholesome consciousness. Adhimokkha brings this faithfulness towards wrong phenomena. So that is also one aspect that we should know about adhimokkha. Then we come into last three mental factors, virya, effort. Virya is effort. Virya is normally explained, it has to be explained with a generation of consciousness. When we are involved in doing a certain act, when we initiate doing a certain act, we may continue without stopping it. So when the virya is there, we would bring that act to the completion. We would terminate it, execute it completely without stopping it in between. So for instance, we sit for meditation for 1 hour, but in the end we end up in half an hour and our body is fatigued, or sometimes we feel tiredness in our mind, so we give up the meditation. But if you keep on doing in a retreat, we find after a few days, you are able to easily sit for 1 hour, maybe 1.5 hours. What has happened? What is the difference in this? Why do we see such a difference? Because the level of virya has increased. That's how we understand virya. Because the virya has increased, mind is capable of continuing in that one particular act without giving it up. So virya is the mental factor which energizes the mind to continue with a certain act without giving up. Then we come into another quality called piti, joy. Joy. Mind is delighted in certain object. It starts to see, like it is, we normally call it delighted, like a flower is blossomed. The mind becomes very happy about certain objects, about certain acts. So that is the piti. It's not found in all the consciousness and it is obvious. Then we come into chanda, zeal. Zeal is to the zeal, the interest, the desire to do certain acts. We are desirous to meditate, we are desirous to, sometimes some people are desirous to steal, some are desirous to donate. So this kind of desire to do a certain act is called chanda. Some conscious may lack this kind of desire. So these are called ethically variable. You can see, because chanda can appear in wholesome and unwholesome side. Joy can appear in wholesome and unwholesome side. So these mental factors, the 13 mental factors which we discussed today, can be happen in both good and bad side. So to conclude, we go to the brief explanation about now these chittas, rootless consciousness, which only have these 13 mental factors associating. Actually, these 18 doesn't have one like chanda. We'll just ignore that part. If we go into the page number 2, we can see the ahetuka consciousness. I'll be explaining this consciousness briefly in one day. because now we have a rough idea about them. Don't worry, I'll be explaining them one after one, one by one in one day. Now, this ahetuka consciousness means they are rootless. They are rootless. Rootless means they do not have lobha, dosa, moha, aloba, dosa, moha. They do not have greed, hatred, delusion, non-greed, non-delusion, non-hatred. So they are very weak. What are these consciousness? There are three. There are three groups. Akusala vipaka, kusala vipaka, and kriya. Right? So I shall explain them. I'm thinking to explain all the consciousness in next week about a rough idea what these consciousness, what are their performances and so forth. So this ruthless consciousness are chakku vinyana, the eye consciousness, upekka sota vinyana, ear consciousness, gana vinyana, the nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, juha vinyana, kaya vinyana is body consciousness, sampatichana santirana, they perform certain functions of receiving and investigating, right? So these are the consciousness. So these seeing, hearing, smelling, touching and all these have the very basic attributes of cognition. They do not have any unwholesome or wholesome attributes. But seeing something, later on we can have unwholesome thoughts. That is a different consciousness. But the act of seeing is associated only with these basic traits only. So then we have kusala vipaka, also similar consciousness. Then we have three kriyas. I shall be explaining them next week. When we explain roughly about the consciousness. So these are the, this is the lecture that I would like to share. Today we discuss about ethically variable 13 mental factors, passa, vedana, sanya, chetana, ekagata, jivitendriya, manasikara, then vitakka, vichara, adimokka, virya, piti, and chanda. The ahetuka consciousness have only these ethically variable ones, but we have to keep in mind ethically variables can be found in kusala, and so akusala, sobana, and even also in ahituka. Right. I hope you got some clarity about this. So next week I'll be explaining about the. Now we explain about the mental factors incomplete, though it's very briefly. We covered all the mental factors. Now we shall cover next week about the consciousness. Now we know why something is called akusala, why something is called sobana, and why this group doesn't have any. This group only have the ethically variable factors. So now we are able to give a brief explanation about what the consciousness does and what is their, what are their attributes. Maybe it may take 2 days. Then we move on to rupa briefly. Then we continue with the remaining remaining parts of the ultimacy about anuppanna and so forth. Yeah. So I would like to open the forum for the Q&A session.
Sir. Thank you, Pate. Hello, everyone. So just like the usual, if you have any questions, please put your question in the chat box and we'll read it out for you, or you can raise your hand and we'll unmute you.
So, we have three questions that were raised 2 weeks ago. I think shared in the Viber group, right? So, I think it's better to answer them first. Lin has asked a question. Can chitta choose not to focus on anything? The answer is no. According to the Theravada tradition, chitta is always associated with, always focused on something. Is there a state of mind which there is no arambana? That is also, answer is no. Always chitta has an arambana. Or focus on nothingness is an arambana. Yes, nothingness is a one object. According to Buddhism, nothingness is also an object. So then we have to understand what is nothingness. So to have an idea of nothingness, we should better go into the sutta called Chula Sunyata Sutta. The Chula Sunyata Sutta. It explains about in the Majjhima Nikaya, Buddha mentions about the emptiness. It says about the emptiness. So what he mentions is, this is the Chula Sunyata Sutta. Chula Sunyata. Sunyata. Right. Chula Sunyata Sutta. Right. For the Sri Lankan audience, this should be written in likewise. So in the Chula Sunyata Sutta, the Buddha mentions someone sees something as empty. So how do we understand the emptiness? If we say this table is empty of books, or if this table is empty of a computer, it doesn't mean the table is empty. There is no table. There is a table, but it is empty of a certain thing. So likewise, Buddha mentions, iti yanhi ko tatta nohoti tena tang sunyan samanupasati. So if there is nothing in a certain thing, we consider that thing is empty of something. Then yampana tatta avasitang hoti tan santa midang attiti pajanat. If there is something left in that, we consider it as something that part is remaining. So when we consider about the nothingness, there are few objects related to nothingness. Especially in the Arupa Jhanas, we consider nothingness of the third Arupa Jhana. Third Arupa Jhana considered about the nothingness of the first Arupa Jhana. So when we say about nothingness, we always relate it to nothingness of something, absence of something. So if we consider about absence of everything, even still that is related to something. So therefore, according to Buddhism, when we say it's nothingness, it's not just like in English, it doesn't refer to normally just mere emptiness. We need to say empty of what? Empty of what? So it doesn't mean, so therefore, now when someone focuses on the emptiness of a certain consciousness, that object is still related to some consciousness, but we focus about the nothingness of that consciousness. So in that sense, we can say, if we consider about nothingness of rupa, nothingness of consciousness, in the end, the essence is nothingness. That's true. But we have to keep, also something that we have to keep in mind, that is that it is related to something, nothingness of something. So this nothingness is also considered as an object in Buddhist teaching. So therefore, the answer according to the Theravada tradition is, there is no citta without an object. Chitta cannot choose to focus, focus not to focus on anything. It always focuses on something, and nothing, if it focuses on nothingness of something, that is also considered as a aramana. Then we have the second question is raised by Uttama the Dhamma seeker. Can we call this focus as the zooming in function of chitta? The zooming in. She has asked the question, zooming. Zooming in. Zoom is also related to our class because we do the class via Zoom. So zooming in means like when we zoom in, it becomes clearer, like the size of the object increases. That's what we know in zooming in computers normally. So actually chitta is, I would prefer to say it as the delimiting of the object rather than zooming in. But sometimes when the object is getting vivid to us, like clear to us, that time we may say we have zoomed in. But I don't see this function in all the chittas. Zooming in is always relative, I feel. Because in one occasion, we focus on the object roughly, generally, or casually. Then we think about it more deeper and we go in, plunge into it. Then we can say we have zoomed relative to the previous act. So when we say zooming, it's always relative according to my understanding. So therefore, when we say the chitta has zoomed into an object, it has zoomed in compared to the previous cognition. If we zoomed in more, so then otherwise we have to understand there is a normal state of knowing and zooming in state. So there, I think, so zooming in can happen in when we compare the two types of knowing. So one is more closer to the object, one is bit far away to the object. So therefore, I would prefer to say the general, like the universal function of consciousness is to delimit the object and to focus on one particular object, giving up the remaining. Right? So that's I think that is more appropriate here. Then Edward has also asked a question. You explain Uddaccha as restlessness, but when it comes to Mohamula type, Mohamula, we have three types of Akusala consciousness. This restlessness cannot be taken as balloon on the flow. Can you explain the Uddaccha at fetter state, please? So Uddaccha is normally said as a balloon because it doesn't remain in the one object, one particular spot, one particular object. It always changes the object. That is the normal function of Uddaccha. So it focuses on a certain object and then suddenly you go into a new another object. So what is this? Then how do we understand the Uddaccha in a one mental state, one mental cluster? Because Uddaccha is explained as a balloon which touches one place and then touches a different place. So it doesn't remain in the one location. So function of Uddaccha is, it makes the mind unstable. It makes the mind unstable on the object. So the grabbing, the cognition, holding of the object, it's not very firm. So what happens, as the consciousness is something in which is in a flux, always arising, passing, and also it has a tendency to go into various objects, that is the nature of the consciousness. Naturally, it has a tendency to go into various objects. So when the Uddaccha makes it unstable, what happens? The next consciousness appears taking a different object. So one consciousness always takes one object. So there is a one-pointedness there. But the Uddaccha makes it weaker. The entire mental cluster becomes weak. So in what sense? In the holding, the grabbing. So it doesn't have a firm footing on the object. So what happens? Because of this weakening, the next chitta, instead of taking the same chitta, it goes into the various chitta. So we understand in practical life, how do we understand Uddaccha? It's very difficult to understand Uddaccha in its actual nature. We understand Uddaccha by the changes of the object, quick changes of the object. So that's how normally we would explain the Uddaccha. So I think maybe that's what he was asking, because it's not very, the question is not, for me it's not very, I didn't get the real idea of the consciousness, why, that's how I thought when the question was put, like it is not, cannot be taken as a balloon. So that's what I imagine seeing the question. Can you explain the Uddaccha at fetter state, please? Fetter is like the realities which bind our mind towards the samsara, which binds our mind towards the samsara. And it's also a very important, very good question. Why Uddaccha has a, what is the fetter quality of Uddaccha? And to be true, in the Theravada tradition, it is one of the very daunting tasks to answer these types of questions. Like why some mental factors are called fetters and why some are not called fetters, certain unwholesome thoughts. Why only four call are asava and why are the remains are not called an asava. There have been some attempts to explain this. This is why and this is why. But when we have various definitions, the ancient teachers have ended up with no proper answer. So therefore, in the Anuttika, it is explained, when we go into find out how to explain what is the fetter quality of Uddaccha, what is the asava quality of this and those. So it's very difficult for us to get an ultimate answer, because we can think about the realities in various ways. So in that sense, they have asked us to because the Buddha has given it, so to accept it. But there is a logic behind it. The thing is, we are unable to give a very exact answer. So for instance, Uddaccha is a fetter and why Kukkuccha is not. So this kind of distinguished clarity is difficult to gain in the Theravada doctrine in this regard. I have to be, if I say frankly. So the fetter state of Uddaccha, according to my understanding, fetters means the mental factor that doesn't let our mind to be freed from the samsara. So when the Uddaccha is present, we are unable to see the real truth of the samsara. So we are unable to get rid of, eradicate the defilements. So Uddaccha is playing a huge role in obstructing us and not letting us to get into the liberation. So that's how I personally feel. Maybe some would have different opinions on that. Then here talked about the ditti and vichikicca. So because when we talked about akusala group, we had in the page number 6, we had ditti in the akusala group. Number 6 is ditti, and then number 14 is vichikicca. 14 is vichikicca. So the other fetter is silabbata paramasa. Silabbata paramasa. Where is silabbata paramasa? Hindin is this explanation. So actually silabbata paramasa falls into ditti. Silabbata paramasa is a one form of ditti. So when someone holds the wrong view that one can get liberated by practicing the bovine or cavine, cavine or bovine, like acting like a oxen or acting like oxen or acting like dogs. So that is a wrong view. So silabbata paramasa falls into ditti in the ultimate sense. Vichikicca is the doubt. Sakkaya ditti is the wrong view about the self. So that is how the three fetters are explained. Yeah. Thank you for all your questions. I think I've answered the questions. So yes, Dr. Ryan, please go ahead.
Thank you, Bhante. Sadhu. I have a question related to the last lecture as well. So because the last lecture you gave the explanation on the paramacchitta.
Ah, yes.
You said that paramacchitta is like the mental state that keeps the mind or prevent the minds from two extremes.
Mm, mm, mm.
Right? So the question is, are these extremes confined only in the arena of wholesomeness the arena of unwholesomeness or wholesomeness as well? Because if we think about extremes, then what about the case of udana, right? Because we know that udana is the situation where the piti is too strong to be held back, right? And it spills in the form of words. So it's a kind of extreme as well. But I mean, we cannot say udana is unwholesome. Udana is definitely wholesome. So how will you explain that?
That's a very good question. So because last time I explained tatra majjatata has the mental factor which keeps the mind apart from the two extremes. So this is what the explanation is given in Paramatta Deepani about... to understand this tatra majjatata. I have come across two different explanations on this mental factor. So one is like, so they divide the word at tatra, majja, atta. So atta is bhava here, we normally call, right? Atta is bhava, sabhava. Sabhava. So majja is between. Right, between. So the nature which lies between. So what are the extremes given here? So the nature which lies between something. Especially this can be found in the beautiful consciousness. So this sabhava is the nature, lies between. If we say this is sabhava, this sabhava lies between two extremes. What are the two extremes? Lina and uddata. That is what two extremes. When the mind is contracted, lina, it doesn't mean laziness, it becomes contracted. So when the mind is contracted, is weakened, this eventually falls into the laziness. If mind is restless, scattered, agitated, it's become agitated. It is agitated. So this is agitation. This is called contracted. Contraction. So when the contraction is there, it falls into thinamidda, laziness. Then if mind is agitated, it falls into restlessness. Then another extreme are explained as atiluka and lukata. I'll give the translation. Then atipahattata. Atilukata and atipahattata. So atilukata means coarseness. It's coarse. We can get gross. Then atipahattata is extreme joy. Extreme joy. So what happens when this the mind is, now this is the one explanation, this is the second explanation. It becomes coarse. What happens? It falls into arati. Arati means not enjoying the spiritual practice. I'll use the word arati, the Pali word. It's not enjoying the spiritual practice. It becomes like very dry. The mind is very dry in meditation and practice, so forth. Then the one, when the mind is extremely joy, it falls into lobha, unwholesome craving. It falls into lobha. So this represents dosa in the attributes, and this represents lobha in one sense, right? So what happens? The sabhava, the atta, which lies between attributes of the between these extreme attributes of the mind. This nature can be called as neutrality. This nature we can call is neutrality. Neutrality. This nature is utterly essential for consciousness to become wholesome. Chittupada, which is together with such nature, is called majjata. So when the mind is with this kind of a nature, which doesn't go into these two extremes, which is called majjata. So majjata means that is the neutral nature of this, this mind. So this is very essential for all the beautiful mentalities, because it makes the mind to be in a balanced state. Doesn't let the mind to go into these extreme steps, because mind goes into these steps, it would end up in here. So now the question comes, as Dr. Ryan asked, now there is something called Udana in our Buddhist teachings. Udana means, according to most of the noble beings who are unable to, a lot of piti arises in them. They are unable to stop this piti, so it comes out at words, comes out as words. It pours out from their mouth as words. There is an entire book called Udana, which explains about the utterances, the joyful utterances made by the nobles, especially the Buddha made the utterances in Udana. And in Theragathas, Therigathas, we can have utterances made by noble arahants and so forth. So how do we understand this extreme joy and Udana? For that, we have to understand, even though we say extreme joy is a problem, extreme joy is a certain extreme, we also can see. Now, for instance, while we are meditating, we see the true natures of the object, and we become really agitated, really excited with that. And then we start to crave towards that, our practice, about our attainments, about our skills. So therefore, we have two types of piti that we can understand. Now, the piti in the jhanas, for instance, is a very high level of intense piti. Though it is the piti is very strong, still it doesn't fall into the unwholesome side. So here, what the Sayadaw is referring, like there is a certain kind of piti with a little bit of an unwise attention without much control, which eventually leads towards the unwholesome craving. Because it's also evident that if we are unable to control our happiness towards certain acts, especially it happens in meditation, when we start to have a good observation, good understanding, we get excited and we start to ponder about it, and then we tend up admiring our qualities and falling into the unwholesome lobha. So that is the piti that has been rejected here, to my understanding, not the piti which is explained in the Udana level, because that PT is like controlled by, to our understanding, controlled by strong mindfulness. So it is like in control. It is fully in control. So then, in the end, we have to come to understanding that even though there is a strong PT utterance in Udana, there is some kind of a control in that. So here we are referring to a PT which is a little bit of out of control. So where we in our natural life, no, day-to-day life, we tend to end up in having unwholesome thought. For instance, someone has certain skills like preaching skills, teaching skills, writing skills. Sometimes we become happy about our skills, and if we keep on thinking about it, like if we get really excited on it, we tend up admiring our qualities in the craving. I think that is the PT that has been discussed here. That's how I feel. But it's a very good question, because we have a Udana, expression of Udana, he's unstoppable. So it comes out as an utterance.
Thank you so much, Pastor Sadhu Sadhu Sadhu. Please go ahead, Sajale Pumya.
Okay.
Yes, Sally. So, before my question, I'd like to say some friends from Myanmar and from other countries, they told me because their internet connection problem, so they couldn't join today's class, so they will watch on YouTube. So my question is regarding the last lecture, or I think previous lecture, about the mana.
Uh-huh.
As we know, so the mana is only eradicated by the arahant matter.
Uh-huh.
So when the Bodhisattva was born, when he was walking, he said, "I'm the highest person in this world."
Yes.
So in that case, he had mana or not? Because he was a Buddhajana at that moment, right? So how can we understand that?
That is also a very important question. Like when we say mana, we explain it as comparison. Like we compare ourselves with others. So also, I think I'm not sure whether I mentioned it or not. When we come into mana, we have to explain that we had also mentioned not all comparisons are mana. There is a vice comparison. Like, for instance, there is a word that is one of the four attributes of a righteous king. Four attributes of a righteous king: dana, piya vachana, attacharya, and samanattata. Shall explain the Pali word. Wait. Samanattata. Samanattata means there are two explanations for this in our tradition. One explanation is, we treat the person in the same way. Like, in front, I treat someone, and also at the absence, I treat him the same. Like, I give a good face when he is present, and I backbite him or stab him from behind. So these things are not admirable in Buddhist teaching. So we have to be very direct or straightforward. We have to treat them equally. And also treating people equally. Like, for a monk, if two people come with different caste, different social rankings, as monks we are supposed to treat them equally. Like, we should not do any favoritism because of the class, rank, and so forth. There are ways that we can have, we may do the discrimination. Discrimination means treat people differently, because if someone is really helpful to the Sangha and he has come to support the Sangha in some occasions, we would give him the priority because it affects the entire Sangha society. So likewise, in Katina and so forth, we have some protocols, but they have to be done with wise attention, not following the instincts, like not following our emotions. So treating people equally is one thing. Then we come into another dilemma. A king treating, these are attributes of a king. Dana, giving, also like can be found in other people. Especially a king has to have these four qualities, like dana, giving charity. Piya vachana, speaking with pleasant words. Attacharya, working for the benefit of others, striving for the benefit of others, for his subject. And samanatata, treating everyone equally. All the citizens should be treated equally by a king. So then another attribute of samanatata, now even a king treating everyone equally, but surely he has to treat the ministers specially because they are important for the country, not because of their personality or something, because they are quite important to the country. And also they would treat the recluses, the religious people, highly, because also they are venerated by the world, and also their presence in the country is helpful to maintain the peace and so forth. Right? Whether it's today happening or not is a different case. Normally, priests, monks, and religious people are supposed to enhance the harmony, the unity among the people. So now the second explanation is mana. Mana is measuring. Samana, sa plus saha, right? Saha mana. So saha mana means, another explanation is, according to the commentarial tradition, we think about the person, about his capacity or about his real qualities, and then treat him accordingly. This is not discriminating. So discriminating based on certain the skin color and so forth, not on such manners. This is like a student cannot treat his teacher like a peer friend, like a colleague. So there should be some differences. Children with the parents with the children. So a parent cannot act with his younger children like he acts with his own brothers or friends. So likewise, in the social hierarchy, there is some common sense that makes us to deal with different people in different manners, not because of any gender or ethical discrimination, because of the real attribute, because of their real social status. In that sense, a leader of a company or a boss and the employees, employer, all these have to have different relationships. So if someone understands this difference and treat them properly, accordingly, that is also considered as one of good attributes of a person. So therefore, comparing people is not mere mana, not an unwholesome act. It can be done with wisdom. So when the Buddha used to say, Bodhisatta uttered, I am the highest at his birth, and also having got enlightened, he uttered that I am, there's no one equal to me, I am the supreme in the world. So such statements were given in many occasions by the Buddha. So these statements are given not because of his arrogance, not because of his pride, because that is the fact. According to us, Buddha is the highest supreme being in the entire universe, entire world. So coming into that position, saying that he is the supreme, that is something not done with mana. And also another thing to explain, the Bodhisattva's miracle happening at the birth, according to the information that we have about in the literature, it seems like, it's also evident, that the Bodhisatta didn't possess all these miraculous attributes after that incident. It means he couldn't walk after that. He couldn't talk afterwards. He was just a child. But on that particular occasion, that miracle happens as an indicator to show that this person is not normal. He would be a special one. Because, for instance, if he was really conscious, he was really aware about all what is happening around him as a grown-up child, because he could walk, he could talk, then we would imagine that he would do all the things after he going to the castle. But it's very clear when the Suddhodana, his father, brought him to his teacher, the Asita the Kaladevala, Bodhisattva couldn't do anything. He was just a child lying on the bed, and suddenly his feet went and touched the head of the hermit. And also, another thing, he understood about the death, according to the tradition, he understood about the death at the age of 29. So, if he was very aware, very conscious, like a grown-up child, as it happened in the birth moment. He would surely know about his mother's death. He would surely know what happened to his mother. So this is also an indicator to show that because in the Nidana Sutta, Mahanidana, if I remember, Buddha mentioned that these miracles would happen at the birth of any bodhisattva during his last life, but it seems like he didn't act as a fully grown child after this incident, because it was just an indicator, a miracle that shows the world that this person is going to be so and so in future. So to your question, mana is not always associated with unwholesome thought. Mana means comparison is not always associated with unwholesome thought.
Okay, my next question is, every time we talk about the Vijayana, is it focus on objects? So when you use the word focus, so which definition are you taking? Is it the Chinta Didi Jaitam or?
Vijanati Ti Vijnana.
Sorry?
Vijanati Ti Vijnana, I take. Vijnana definition. Vijnana.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Pati. Sadhu.
I think we can have one more question because we started a bit late. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, thank you, Pati. Please go ahead, Mr. Ananda.
Yes.
Thank you, Pati. Actually, I have two, three questions I'll ask from you. First, Bhante, now, as the earlier question, Udana and Tanha, Chanda and Tanha, so what's the difference between Chanda and Loba? Like, you know, these are kind of, like, for example, if you're striving on attaining Nirvana, so one might say that, you're creating Tanha there. So, that's the first one.
Yeah, it's also something very important to clarify, because Chanda and Tanha has very close attributes. Chanda is also a desire. Tanha is also a desire. So the Tanha is, the difference of Tanha is, it is attached to a certain particular object. The definition of Tanha is attached to a certain object. Definition of Chanda is the desire to do something. So if I write it here, attachment towards an object, Lobha. Attachment towards an object, Chanda, desire to do something, right? To do. This is towards an object. This is how the basic definition comes within the tradition. So now we can have counter questions on this. We can have counter questions. If someone does sexual misconduct, is it done with only Chanda or Lobha? Isn't the attachment, desire to do an unwholesome act, isn't it activated with Lobha? Yes, surely there should be Lobha. How about Kama Chanda? Desire for sensual pleasures. Isn't the desire for sensual acts is not Lobha? So these kind of questions should obviously come when we have these two definitions. So now what we have to think is, there is a Chitta with Lobha and Chanda together. There is a Chitta only with Chanda. Right? Only with Chanda. Now, in the Dosa Mula, when we have hatred also, we have a certain desire to harm someone, to hit someone. It's motivated with anger. It's mixed with anger. So according to the fundamentals, anger and Lobha can never happen together. So such a desire, if we have such a drive to do such an act, that is obviously made by Chanda. Then we have a desire to do wholesome deeds. Like I want to really help someone with a pure intention. I'm not talking about a wholesome act motivated by to become famous and so forth. So at that time we may have Lobha Chittas, Kusala Chittas on and off. So in that case it's very difficult to distinguish whether my act is at a certain moment, whether it's wholesome or unwholesome, but giving itself is wholesome because that's the moment we give up. though it's motivated by unwholesome thoughts. So if we think about a pure kusala, just giving someone to support him or for to give up our attachment, to develop our detachment, that desire, that wanting to do that act is purely chanda, because fundamentally lobha cannot happen with kusala chitta. Then we come into the lobha chitta. Someone wants to do a sexual act, misconduct, or to steal something, to become famous, just motivated by the ego or something. So at that time, we find lobha and chanda together. Lobha and chanda together. This is the point, it is very difficult to distinguish. So at that moment, if we have a certain desire to do something, the urge is made by chanda. The attachment towards that act, the liking towards that act is called lobha. So the difference between lobha and chanda, the chanda should be understood as a desire, a force to perform the action. Attachment is the lobha. So how do we understand this attachment? So the explanation given in the commentary is to understand the attachment is when we lose that object, when we lose that opportunity to do that act, if we really feel sorrow, if we really get devastated, it's not because like sometimes we have an opportunity to give dana and we miss it, and then we may feel, I couldn't do it, so I missed an opportunity. Likewise, such thoughts may occur, that is obvious, when we lose something important that was beneficial for us. But if we have real lobha towards a certain act, we start to miss that object. We start to miss doing that act. So that sorrow that we have losing something that we like, desire, or losing something which was beneficial, have two types of emotional effects. So lobha should be understood. Lobha doesn't like the desired object for us to be apart from that desired object. So that's how we distinguish the lobha, that it doesn't tolerate, that's the explanation, it doesn't tolerate the separation from that object. Why is that? Because it is totally attached. The chanda is the force, the seal to do such acts. Then we come into a more complicated question. Now, someone is desires to give dana, someone is desires to become a Buddha, someone is desires to become Agasavaka. So normally we say that is made by kusala chanda without any lobha. There can be lobha, I'm not saying no. In some occasions, to become a Buddha, even someone can have a lobha, because even towards nirvana, we can have lobha in the conventional level. Nirvana is never object ultimately of lobha, but as a panyati, as a concept, we may have attachment towards nirvana, nothing to say about the Buddhahood, nothing to say about the Arahanthood, but it doesn't mean that all the desires to become a Buddha is motivated by lobha, because when someone wants to become Arahant, he wants to eradicate the defilement. So in most of the occasion, it is pure wholesome with the wholesome chanda desires. How do we understand that there is no wholesomeness? There is no unwholesomeness in most of the occasions. But I would not deny the fact that there can be lobha. There can be lobha in some instances. Why? How do we explain that pure chanda was present? Because that chanda is capable of eradicating the lobha. That chanda was capable of eradicating the lobha. But then a question may come, tanham nisaya tanham pajahati. Based on tanha, sometimes we give up tanha. There is a teaching given by Venerable Ananda. And also he mentioned in the end, in one sutta Buddha mentioned, but when you go into higher levels, it is not possible without giving up that craving, you enter into nirvana. So therefore, ultimately we give up. Chanda is the opposing force. Wholesome chanda is opposing to unwholesome craving. That's why someone could abandon the attachment towards the family, towards the wealth, and cut off that bondage and go to ordination, go to the forest. There is a great zeal, great desire, great wanting to come into that pure state that is completely motivated by wholesome thoughts. So that is called pure chanda. But I would not deny the fact that in some occasions, for some people, such motivations can also be associated by lobha, We cannot deny the fact there is a possibility. The complicated question is, now we think about Piyo Kusala. Piyo Kusala. Think now, someone is not affected by Lobha, doing the act with a pure wholesome mind like Dana. For that, he has to gather the stuff. He has to gather what is to be given. So in that case, he has, after he has gathered, he has a certain liking, certain desire to protect this stuff, because with this he is going to accumulate a great merit for his liberation, for instance. So he has an attachment, like a liking towards this stuff which is going to be given. According to the tradition, even though Chanda is explained as a desire to do, the sub-commentators explain the attachment towards the things to be given, attachment towards the attachment or liking towards the things to be given should also be the functioning of Chanda. Should also be functioning of Chanda if it is really motivated by wholesome thought. But I don't deny the fact that Lobha can appear there in some occasions. But mostly we say it's pure wholesome. So in that case, the example is given. Similar, the analogy was given. The archers. Archers knowing that they would get a salary from the king, they would gather the arrows. These arrows are not going to be kept for themselves. They are going to shoot them, but they still desire for these arrows because of the salary they are going to get. Why they like the arrows? Not to cling on them, not to hold like our own wives or husbands of children. They are going to give up these arrows, but they like it because with these they are going to get more benefits of salary. So likewise, if you think about the liberation with the dana, we, someone may like the stuff that is going to be offered. That is not because they are clinging towards the object. That is not because they like the object, because they are desiring for a greater liberation, that is the eradication of tanha one day. So that's how we explain that. It's a very slight tough question. Like, there's a slight difference about chanda and lobha. That's how I would normally explain this. I hope it was clear. Yeah. So if you have any questions.
Just one. So is it like you are desiring to letting go? Is that, can we say like that?
Desiring to letting go is chanda normally. Desiring to letting go is chanda.
I have another question if you have time, I don't know.
Shall we take it to the next week? Send me the questions. I'll like we did today. I will take them in the next question and Q&A session. Just write it on the Zoom or to my Viber. I will take them next week.
Okay, thank you.
So I think it's already 10. We shall.
Thank you so much, Bhante. Bhante, I have a really quick question, Bhante. I just want to know the reference that you gave in the explanation earlier, the reference about the Buddha or the Venerable Ananda saying that, you know, you might have some bad thought or, you know, the unwholesome.
Tanhang Nisaya. If you can type this, Tanhang Nisaya, Tanhang Pajahati. Tanhang Nisaya, Tanhang Pajahati. This is what I remember in the Pali term. I'll search for it and give the exact reference.
Okay, thank you so much.
So we may call it a day, and all the wholesome deeds that we have accumulated, may this support us for our liberation and also for the prolongation of the Buddha Sasana. Buddha Sasanang Chirantithatu, Buddha Sasanang Chirantithatu. Buddha sasanang chirantithatu, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.